You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Spring 2026 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of The Man, the Metropolis, and the $720 million Museum by Nate Freeman, with photographs by Max Farrago. Criticism is subjective, but the numbers don't lie. Scraping together the funds was always going to be a massive undertaking. Board co-chair Willow Bay, the dean of the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, has been a trustee since 2007, shortly after Govan stepped in as director. Once Govan brought in his plan for Sumtor to completely rethink the museum campus, the board snapped into action. The first step wasn't asking for money. It was making sure that the idea was strong enough, powerful enough, to deserve a campaign of this scale, says Bay, who for years has funded the maintenance of Chris Burden's Urban Light, along with her husband, Disney CEO Bob Iger. We ask lots of questions about the design, about the finances, about the impact that it would have, pressure testing the notion that it would have the kind of impact we believed that it would. Eventually, the board did have to ask for money. After some false starts, a windfall came when David Geffen, the longtime contemporary art collector, made his historic pledge in 2017, injecting some excitement into a campaign that had been sputtering. Govan watched as the budget ballooned, and what was initially supposed to be a $650 million building became a $720 million albatross. But miraculously, the building's form started to take shape, and when Angelino started to get wind of the finished product, people actually seemed to like it. The most brash design feature, the bridge that allows cars to drive directly below installed artworks, as museum-goers crossed the Miracle Mile from above, started to get serious praise after it finally vaulted over the road in 2024. Wilshire is a real kind of symbolic divide, if you will, Mitchell says. All of the museums and all of that was literally on the north side of Wilshire. And to build this literal and figurative bridge deeper into the deep culture, the ethnic culture of L.A. between Koreatown and Little Ethiopia and South L.A., it's a bridge across into the district that's really powerful. Govan, for his part, downplays the controversy. When we proposed the Guggenheim in Bilbao and that whole project, there were protests in the street, he says. There were no protests in the street here. He is walking from outside of one of the walled-off rooms that punctuate the single-floor flow-through space, perhaps the only partitions in a museum building that lacks transitional corner turns and corridors, which traditionally break up an art-viewing excursion. I'm super empathetic, he says. Every once in a while, you need to try new things. I always say L.A. is the place to try it. I don't know that you try this in even Chicago or Cincinnati. L.A.'s the place. For years, he was in what he says was an impossible situation. He had to sell the idea of the building years before residents could see it, feel it, drive by it, walk into it. Sumtor wasn't brand name famous among Angelenos. Odds are most Dodgers fans haven't seen, say, his Kunsthaus Bregenz in a small town on the northern edge of the Austrian Alps. And if you've never seen it before, how are you going to get it? Govan admits. Certainly in places like Dia Beacon, if I had shown it to everybody, it'd be, that's weird. Why would you have 17 artists in a giant factory space like that? But of course, we didn't have the scrutiny. So the editorials, the outrage, the pulling of promised gifts, all that stuff made sense to him. If they don't have an opinion, then you have to worry, he says. If you're in a city, you're in a civic space. Geffen was unfazed. I have spent most my life working with artists and never cared about criticism of their work. Michael had an idea that I believed in. Sumtor's design was magnificent, and L.A. is better because of them both. That simple, he says. Next photos, artist Sandy Rodriguez, Gerardo Gomez, gallery lighting assistant, and Christine Ferreter, senior gallery lighting designer. Govan mentions that in discussions with the museum's public relations team, one school of thought focused on winning over the public writ large, that the idea was to get everybody on your side, as he puts it. He disagreed. And I was like, no, let people get invested, he says. Tsumtor says that Govan had the best advice for tuning out the criticism of the plan. Once, years ago, I asked, Michael, should I follow this newspaper discussion? Tsumtor recalls. Then he said, no, forget it. You don't have to do this. You do the building. I do the politics. LACMA opens to the public next month and will host a number of big wigs for a series of dinners and activations. It's intended to be a celebration for the Angeleno artist community, especially for those commissioned to make works for the new museum and the plaza. Jeff Koons, Liz Glynn, Thomas Hausiago, Shio Kusaka, Pedro Reyes, Diana Tatar, to name a few. Inevitably, there will be impromptu photo shoots next to the most photographed work in LACMA's collection, Urban Light, the series of street lamps that acts as catnip to tourists and influencers. But one sculpture installed beside the new museum is getting more attention than most. That would be Koons' Split Rocker, a massive kid's rocking horse cut down the middle and merged with a dinosaur's head, then covered in flowers. Donated by longtime patrons Linda and Stuart Resnick, it hugs the road in a way that makes it unmissable to commuters on their way west down Wilshire. Once upon a time, another Koons was set to grace the new LACMA, but it's since drifted into Koonsian lore, as perhaps his most batshit ambitious unrealized project. Koons called the Titanic sculpture Train, and it was going to be a 70-foot replica of a 1940s locomotive, suspended nose to tail from a 160-foot crane. Go West, Young Man Manifesto. Go West, Young Man Manifest Density writ large, an American magnum opus too quixotic even for Hollywood. Eli Broad loved Jeff Koons, so I thought I'd get some support. We worked with Disney Imagineering. We scanned a train, and Wallace Annenberg helped me with it. But the scale of the project was, in the end, bigger than a building, Govan says. The train was never constructed, and Split Rocker is maybe better for the museum at the end of the day. It even edges LACMA back toward its historical predecessors, the old world encyclopedic museums, the ones that Govan is in some way trying to replace, but is inevitably forever measured against. It is a guardian, he says, of the disjointed rocking horse. Urban Light is the Greco-Roman temple facade. Barbara Kruger's piece is like the entry text you get that's supposed to be friendly, but it's contemporary. The Heiser sort of fills in for the obelisk, and this is, for me, like the lions in front of the Art Institute of Chicago, the guardians on this side. He pauses for a second as the magic hour light comes over his museum, decades in the making, without the public having stepped inside yet. Will it be an old museum or a new museum? It will be both. They'll make up their minds and they're going to come see it. The number of people who've actually seen it from here is minuscule, he says. You know Frank Gehry now, but Disney Hall? Quite controversial, I say. I don't think that was any different, was it? It turned out okay, he goes on. So I think that's kind of great that LA's had this boldness of thinking differently and people sticking with things. He takes one more glance at the Koons that came to be from a walkway in the sky on top of a boulevard. Yeah, Govan says, I think that looks so good. the crypto keepers. What happens when you've devoted your life to crypto and the market plummets by 50%, leaving you billions poorer on paper in a matter of days or weeks? Clara Malotte gathers the industry's most significant digital millionaires and billionaires and its truest believers to figure out what comes next after one of the coldest winters since the industry's inception. Photographer Jeremy Liebman contributed to this article. Opening photo off the blockchain. The faces behind crypto's faceless industry lost billions and kept the faith anyway. Welcome to the most expensive religion in the world. Curated by Sittings editor Nicole Chapoteau. Next photo, Olef Carlson Wee, the Bitcoin playboy. When Carlson Wee's not running one of crypto's largest hedge funds, he can be found jetting to the United Arab Emirates, where he was recently spotted bleach blonde on a mega yacht celebrating Token 2049, a far cry for a preacher's kid. "I don't think I can do this anymore," read one of the dozens of signal messages that a major crypto market maker, who asked to go simply by Bison, received in the first few days of February. The crypto market had just shed another 15%, some $400 billion gone in a matter of days. In the previous 4 months, the total value of cryptocurrencies had plunged nearly 50%. Dragged down by Bitcoin, with both Ethereum and Solana dropping nearly 60%. The crash erased roughly $2 trillion in value and tipped the industry into a bear market known in crypto slang as a winter. A nerdy subterranean nod to Game of Thrones' foreboding refrain, "Winter is coming." Bison recounts stories of top founders scrambling to take companies private, close emergency equity rounds, or abandon ship altogether. Veterans of the space have endured worse, with the market dropping 80 or even 90%, but this season felt different. Not to make it about me, but the timing, from my perspective, was comically bad. In October, as euphoria under a deregulated crypto-friendly Trump administration pushed the market toward its peak, I had begun working on a feature about the faces behind an often faceless industry. As the market stalled, so did several of my conversations with prospective participants, some of whom had viewed this kind of press as a victory lap. Executives at Coinbase fell conspicuously silent as its CEO, Brian Armstrong, watched an estimated $10 billion evaporate from his net worth while battling regulators in Washington. Tensions simmered within Ethereum's ranks, where its quasi-mythic co-founder Vitalik Buterin fired off tweets about his concerns for the way his platform is scaling, and as an early Polymarket backer, his distaste for the ultra-addictive direction of blockchain-based prediction markets. Rank-and-file traders, dismissed by OGs as tourists, either panic-sold, drifted toward shinier obsessions like AI and prediction markets, or quietly shed the identity of crypto bro altogether. "They're all pussies," says Meltem Demirers, an early crypto investor who now runs her own firm, Crucible Capital, of her panicked peers. She is layered in diamond crosses and wearing a black sweatsuit with her firm's slogan, "Believe in something," bedazzled across the ass. For the first time in years, she is buying Bitcoin again. And so, on a biting February afternoon, as the market continued its slide, a small circle of true believers gathered inside a Beaux-Arts landmark on the Lower East Side, a former bank, once nicknamed the Temple of Capitalism, now reborn, a reported $300 million later as the Nine Orchard Hotel. Michael Novogratz, CEO of Galaxy Digital, is its newly minted co-owner. Collectively billions poorer on paper, Novogratz, Demirers, and other crypto players, Olaf Carlson Wee, Kathy Wood, and Danny Ryan, compared notes. Not about what they had sold, but about what they were buying. Wood, armed with reams of proprietary research, and Carlson Wee, who insists he never follows the news, are accumulating Bitcoin. Ryan shrugs off the daily noise altogether. "I'm a Luddite," he proclaims. "People will tell me when I need to know something." "Technology without belief," Demirers reiterates. "Technology without spirituality is nothing." Unlike Jesus' followers, who doubted his resurrection, crypto's true disciples aren't losing faith. "Really," Demirers says, "what we were building was a religious movement." Asset classes, whether gold, commodities, real estate, bonds, or stocks, are an answer to the same question: where does value come from? They are social constructs that mean something because we collectively agree they do. Gold says, from nature and scarcity. Bonds say, from institutional trust. Real estate says, from place and permanence. Commodities say, from matter itself. Stocks say, from human ingenuity. Each one needs a creative myth, from scarcity to capitalism itself. But for those who believe crypto is the sixth asset class, it works precisely because they insist that its value is more than financial. "I have been waiting for this since we closed the gold window in 1971. Wood, who's actively managed ETFs, bet highly on disruptive technology, recalls being told by Arthur Laffer, the Reagan-era economics titan who developed the Laffer curve. "How big could this idea be?" Wood asked him. His answer revealed the fantasies of crypto's earliest adherents. "Well, how big is the U.S. monetary base?" On Halloween in 2008, just 6 weeks after Lehman Brothers, the fourth largest investment bank in the country, imploded, taking with it the myth of institutional security, a mysterious figure under the pseudonym Satoshi Nakamoto quietly emailed a short list of cryptographers a 9-page PDF titled Bitcoin, a Peer-to-Peer Electronic Cash System. Now known simply as the White Paper, Nakamoto outlined a novel financial system that completely bypassed central authorities, like banks, governments, the Federal Reserve, and as a result, would insulate everyday people from inflation, seizure, and the caprices of monetary policy. Bitcoin secures itself through mining, specialized computers competing to solve cryptographic puzzles, and access depends on the ability to memorize a specific series of words. Lose the phrase, and the funds are gone forever. Remember it, and you could reclaim your wealth from anywhere in the world without asking anyone's permission. By 2009, Nakamoto took Bitcoin from theory to reality, mining the Genesis block. And then, once the rules were set, protections against counterfeits were secured, and Bitcoin began to circulate, still worth next to nothing, Nakamoto vanished. His disappearance not only deepened the myth, but granted Bitcoin true decentralization. No longer was there an omnipotent figure at the reins. Now the experiment belonged to everyone and no one. "I fell in love with it," says Eric Voorhees, founder of Shapeshift Currency Exchange and Venice AI, who discovered Bitcoin in 2011 while working for the Libertarian Free State Project in New Hampshire. "I thought Bitcoin might take over the world," he says, enamored that it couldn't be debased, that no single person or company controlled it, and that nobody could stop it. The movement took hold in the fringes of society, among a ragtag group of misfits, disillusioned with the post-recession world, and in search of both social and political change. Its early believers were mostly young, mostly male, and hyper-online. They were cyberpunks on message boards, creating their own echo chamber, and convinced that cryptography could do what regulators never would, redistribute power. It was like the rebels in Star Wars, says Novogratz, who was wearing his new red Valentino suit at the photo shoot, and describing a movement that saw itself as small, scrappy, but morally certain. Once you really understand Bitcoin, says Carlson Wee, the founder and CEO of the crypto hedge fund Polychain Capital, you can't unsee it. He first encountered Bitcoin on an online forum during his senior year at Vassar College in 2011, and was quickly overtaken with a conviction that cryptocurrency was the future of global finance, even persuading his thesis advisors to let him write about it. After graduating, while working as a lumberjack in Washington, he cold emailed his resume and thesis to Coinbase, then a tiny startup operating out of a San Francisco apartment. He was hired within days as Coinbase's first employee. In those early days, it felt like everybody knew a secret the rest of the world didn't know about yet. By the time Occupy Wall Street began sounding the alarm bells about growing wealth inequality in the U.S., the crypto ideals of self-sovereignty and the global democratization of financial access also resonated with a generation that had watched trillions in household wealth evaporate while the government bailed out the banks. My first day on the trading floor was the day after Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, says Arthur Hayes, who is snowed in on a remote Japanese island, unshaven and clad in a red thermal T-shirt. An interesting way to start your financial services career. Hayes had aimed squarely at traditional finance, Wharton, Deutsche Bank, Citigroup. But watching colleagues get fired while markets collapsed pushed him toward assets he could control. First gold, and then in 2013, Bitcoin. By 2014, between jobs and living on a friend's couch, 28-year-old Hayes co-founded BitMEX, which brought Wall Street, grade, leverage, and derivatives to crypto traders and would eventually create the perpetual swap. Instead of buying Bitcoin and holding it, now traders could place leveraged bets of 10, 50, even 100 times their initial stake on whether its value will rise or fall. Some died, some went bankrupt, some did really well, Hayes says flatly of the early converts whose fortunes were sometimes made or obliterated in a matter of minutes. The product exploded, generating trillions and minting a new class of crypto degenerates who were willing to take massive risk that occasionally resulted in millions. It turned crypto into a casino. Next photo, Michael Novogratz, the Wall Street rebel. Before he became a multi-billionaire, Novogratz felt the distance between his world and his college roommates, a son of Gloria Vanderbilt. He remembers emailing his mom, "Rich people sheets kick the shit out of our sheets." When no one is in charge, who gets to decide the future? That was the point, and also the problem. Disagreements bubbled up about everything from ethical use cases to whether Bitcoin's ecosystem should expand to include new tokens. Still, it was precisely this unruly coalition, libertarians, venture capitalists, builders, traders, scammers, that went on to push crypto into the mainstream. The same year that Hayes made Bitcoin feel closer to gambling than to gold, Buterin, a spindly 20-year-old teal fellow who looked like he should be walking a Demna-era Balenciaga show, blew the industry wide open. Novogratz recalls the afternoon in 2014 when his Princeton roommate, Joseph Luman, brought him to Brooklyn to meet members of the Ethereum Foundation, who would launch their platform the following year. Through smart contracts, self-executing code living on the blockchain, Ethereum meant that developers could suddenly build entire financial universes, lending platforms, digital art markets, self-governing organizations. No banks, no corporate overlords, just code. Lubin had almost a religious conversion, says Novogratz. recalling being told Ethereum is going to change and save the world. Lubin had visions of entire economies migrating onto the chain, stable coins supporting fragile third world currencies, open source finance replacing the opacity of legacy banking. I didn't need the world to be saved because I was already rich, says Novogratz, but I was like, this is kind of cool. I didn't have the aha moment with Bitcoin, says Etherealize co-founder and president Danny Ryan, his long hair braided, wearing a thin black t-shirt and jean jacket on a single-digit degree New York day, and a plastic yellow nose ring he claims helped him breathe. Instead, his revelation came in 2016 when he discovered Ethereum. By January 2017, his sole focus was making himself useful at Buterin's Foundation, where he would soon be hired just as crypto burst into the mainstream. It was an effing moment in time, says Demirers, recalling the day she knew she'd made it, a conference that November, where she watched the Ethereum nerds clad in unicorn t-shirts and Hawaiian button-downs, instruct the newly arrived Goldman and Andreessen Horowitz types on how to set up MetaMask wallets and participate in ICOs. Bitcoin had hit $10,000, and crypto's total market capitalization surged from $16 billion to a peak of $535 billion that year, an annual growth rate exceeding 3,200%. Demirer says, I went on a Net-a-Porter and bought myself a pair of red Giuseppe Zanotti heels and had them same day delivered to the conference. Ethereum meant there was no longer one coin, one origin myth, or one philosophy. Anyone could build anything. It shattered singularity, but it also fractured unity. Next photo, Milton Demirers, the couture venture evangelist. The Crucible Capital founder judges potential investments on a sliding scale of Riz, charisma, and Tiz, autism. Here's the secret to lasting a really long time, she says. You never become the main character. Everybody knows who I am, but nobody really knows why. The U.S. government never quite knew what to do with an industry whose founding premise was to evade centralized authority. To regulators, crypto appeared as one impenetrable blur of internet scam. The market would spend the next decade swinging between euphoria and collapse, wiping out the life savings of many while producing generational wealth for the savvy few who correctly rode the wave. Yet inside of crypto's ecosystem, the divisions appeared enormous. Old guard versus tourist, ideologue versus grifter, builder versus trader. There are two kinds of crypto bro, says Voorhees. The first is the legitimate crypto bro, someone philosophically aligned with Bitcoin's original ethos who cares about decentralization, privacy, and individual sovereignty, he says. They are vilified because they stand on principles that many modern institutions, specifically the government and its bedfellows, fiat banks, abhor. Then there are the tourists and scammers. These are the guys driving around in Lambos slinging meme coins, he says. They have no principle. They generally showed up after 2017. They range from outright scammers to the slightly grifty, to honest fools who don't know any better. They're vilified because they rightly suck. Meanwhile, one crypto holder, let's call him Moose, pulls out an ID card from Palau, a sovereign island off the coast of Micronesia that he ordered online for $200, and shows it to me like it's a joke, which it partly is, except it's also how he accesses offshore derivatives platforms unavailable to Americans. Everyone does this, he says. He's 27, and like many men his age, he first encountered crypto while trying to buy drugs and fake IDs on Silk Road in the mid-2010s. His heroes aren't athletes or movie stars, but anonymous Twitter accounts, anime avatars and pseudonyms with cryptic bios, whose followers track their trades with devotional intensity. Jordan Fish occupies a different register of the same world. Known online as Kobe, his Telegram profile photo is a fluffy white puppy mid-jump. He made early money in Lido, the staking protocol that democratized Ethereum validation, and later founded Echo, a members-only crypto investment platform worth north of $300 million. Being a crypto bro was almost cool in 2019, he tells me over encrypted chat. Now it's very much not cool. As crypto moved from fringe to mainstream to cultural punchline, its promise of revolution faded. The men who once styled themselves renegades increasingly resembled every other hyper online young guy, gaming, memeing, trading. The aesthetic didn't help. There were the infamous conference after parties, Hayes' 2023 rave in Singapore during Token 2049 that drew thousands and ran out of alcohol after only an hour, ending in security fending off a mob of wasted and determined crypto bros who were all but scaling walls to get in. At the same conference 2 years later in Dubai, Carlson Wee, who jets between California and the United Arab Emirates, where he has reportedly worked on projects with the government, partied on a Lotus mega yacht alongside Jordan Jefferson, CEO of Doge OS. Reportedly sporting a t-shirt of what he calls Habibi Doge, a Shibu Inu in a customary Emirati headdress called a Kandura. A UAE-linked firm, notably, had purchased a $500 million stake in a Trump family crypto venture shortly before his inauguration. There was even that party where Rick Ross had to fend off an army of crypto nerds who were trying to scale the stage. I went to La Guerte for like 3 days straight, says Demirers, of last year's Ethereum conference in Cannes. I was drunk and army crawling on the table. She adds, It will never be in June again. Ethereum people hate nice things and having fun. They want you to eat tofu and wear organic cotton only and suffer. Everyone assumes if you've made money in crypto, you're in a yacht in Miami with 100 prostitutes, says Demirers, whose interests include alien and rocket research, collecting esoteric objects of divine provenance, and learning how to survive in a wide range of conditions with no equipment or tools. And then there are the whales, Bitcoin's own leviathans. In crypto slang, the term refers to individuals who have more than 1,000 BTC, but they often possess upwards of $10 billion worth of digital assets, sums large enough to move markets with a single transaction. The whales are completely anonymous. They don't attend conferences, host parties, or fire off controversial tweets. Underscoring a point raised by almost everyone I spoke to for this story, the loudest voices in crypto are rarely the richest. Anonymity, once an ideological rejection of centralized power, is also practical. Visibility in crypto is a liability. The industry sees dozens of violent attacks a year, kidnappings, home invasions, armed robberies. Massive data leaks expose holdings, turning digital wealth into physical targets. Last year, a crypto holder in Nolita escaped his alleged attackers after what he says was 2 weeks of being tortured for his password. I stopped being a public figure, Fish says, because it's likely a personal risk. Devin Finzer and his wife, Yuchi Lirakuo, meanwhile, travel with an enormous looming man who looks more Viking than Secret Service. That's our bodyguard, Kuo says casually. Demirers has her own theory about longevity. So here's the secret to lasting a really long time, she says. You never become the main character. I'm a side character. Everybody knows who I am, but nobody really knows why. Next photo, Danny Ryan, the barefoot builder. Running Etherealize, a company attempting to bring Wall Street onto the blockchain, has Ryan spending his days talking to men in suits, which is an adjustment from his old gig designing apps for a duty-free theme park on the Mexican border. On the morning of the photo shoot, Wood doesn't recognize Demirers, whom she hasn't seen in over a decade. "You somehow look younger," Wood says, pulling her into a hug. "It's because I'm rich now," Demirers responds with a smirk. Carlson Wee introduces himself to Wood with the sweet docility of a young boy meeting his hero. They immediately dive into conversation about the years when everyone thought they were crazy, affirming their shared conviction that when the market's down, you buy, lightly skirting the reality that crypto is down nearly 50% from 3 months ago. Novogratz swaggers in wearing a full-length silver puffer jacket, greeting everyone warmly before announcing that he really wishes he weren't on day two of a gnarly hangover. He then proceeds to describe a Saturday night that climaxed with a 4 a.m. trip to the Burning Man-inspired New York nightclub Gospel, which he hopes his 30-year-old daughter and her new husband, who live nearby, did not witness. Ryan keeps to the room's edges, watching with a mix of amusement and horror. Demirers and her assistant flip through the options they've brought, Kite, Schiaparelli, and Jill Sander. Novogratz deliberates between a bedazzled black suit and that Valentino. Ryan, meanwhile, brought his only two pairs of pants. His favorite has a hole in the crotch. He wears them anyway. "I'm so hot," he complains, barefoot, as the hairstylist blow-dries his thick locks, which graze his shoulders. "Where's Devin?" Demirers ask. Finzer and Kuo are four floors above in their own private suite, with a personal team of assistants, security, and celebrity hair and makeup artist, surrounded by racks of couture. "I have Armani Privé flying in," Kuo tells me, "an elegant black jacket from Mr. Armani's last collection before he passed away." Then to the fashion director, someone from Jean-Paul Gaultier Haute Couture flew in with options. In the end, after millions of dollars of couture have been considered, she chooses an Armani gown that isn't even couture and foregoes wearing her J.A.R. jewelry. "You look like an effing clown," Demirers texts Kuo when she learns the pair upstairs with an entire team. Finzer co-founded the NFT marketplace OpenSea in 2017, which means that in the eyes of crypto's pioneers, and even his wife, he missed the critical cutoff to be considered an OG. His origin story reads like a Silicon Valley mother's dream. He grew up outside San Francisco, went to Brown, majored in computer science and math, took a job as a software engineer at Pinterest, and then, as crypto exploded into the mainstream, he and a friend, Alex Atala, decided to build essentially the eBay of digital assets. Inspired by the tokenization happening on Ethereum, and particularly the explosion of the digital cat trading platform CryptoKitties, they launched OpenSea. Shortly after COVID hit, bored at home, a generation of young men flooded into the online universe of crypto, and NFTs took off. By 2021, Beeple NFT artwork sold at Christie's for $69 million, and avatars like Bored Ape Yacht Club and CryptoPunks had become status symbols, in the way a Rolex or a Porsche once was. Someone apparently even spent more than $1 million for clip art of a rock. By January 2022, OpenSea's valuation skyrocketed to more than $13 billion. That same year, as a young Finzer scrambled to keep pace with a rapidly growing company and found himself suddenly admitted to the top echelons of Silicon Valley society, he met Kuo. "She was like a Ferrari engine inside a hot girl," he says. He calls me the day before the shoot to say he will only participate if Kuo, whom he describes as his co-founder of OpenSea 2.0, stands next to him in the photograph. The request triggers eye rolls from their fellow participants, who laugh and chat between frames, barely acknowledging the couple. Moments Finzer and Kuo use instead to get touch-ups from their own hair and makeup team. The tension is palpable. Next photo, Kathy Wood, the market prophet. Wood's exchange-traded fund, ARKK, is named after the Ark of the Covenant, the gold-covered chest inscribed in the Book of Exodus that carried the Ten Commandments. She has been crowned the best stock picker in the market in 2020 and the worst in 2022. A few days later, back in their everyday athleisure, Kuo and Finzer reflect on OpenSea's past. Kuo tells me that she had expressed her doubts to Finzer about OpenSea even before the moment in 2022 when the crypto market crashed and the NFT bubble burst, but that it fell on deaf ears. OpenSea was too trendy and Finzer too immature and short-sighted, she says, to pivot quickly enough towards something more enduring. My family measures things in generations, she tells me, but people in crypto measure things in years. Everybody was blowing smoke up his ass. Forbes, Devin's face, 20 years old, 29 years old, good looking. Everybody wants to fly him private to the Super Bowl, take him to every gala. She pauses. I'm not impressed by this stuff. It was just a humbling process, adds Finzer quietly. Even though all these people have gassed you up, you have so much to learn. The market has been building towards a collapse for months. Bitcoin fell from its 2021 peak of $69,000 to $16,000, kicking off the worst winter the industry had seen. OpenSea's valuation tumbled about 90%. Terra Luna imploded in May 2022, erasing more than $40 billion from the Terra ecosystem in 72 hours, wiping out retail investors worldwide. Three Arrows Capital, one of crypto's largest hedge funds, collapsed shortly after. Then in November came the infamous fall of Sam Bankman-Fried's exchange FTX, the industry's golden child, undone in a week. He would ultimately be arrested and convicted of 7 counts of fraud and conspiracy, stealing as much as $10 billion from customers. Devin isn't my first time advising one of the Wonder Kids, Kuo says, without elaborating. As the company cratered and the NFT bubble burst, Kuo became what she calls Finzer's product mommy and considers Finzer her Build-A-Bear. Now they're relaunching OpenSea as something that they claim is even more ambitious. We tell normal people it's an expansion, she says, but it's the world, explaining that the normies, those outside the crypto space, can't yet fathom what technology will do to their lives in the next 5 to 10 years. As the OGs are tired and quitting, she says, we feel more animated than ever. Not everyone shares the conviction. The more blockchain infrastructure matures, the harder it becomes to explain what OpenSea's platform offers that trading venues like Coinbase or Gemini don't. The projects that are succeeding have raised the bar. Hyperliquid and Uniswap, for example, now share revenue with token holders. Most tokens can't compete with that model. The majority are issued primarily for governance purposes, giving holders a vote on protocol decisions, but no direct stake in the company's economics. The demise of FTX not only sent the whole industry into freefall, but ignited what the crypto world would come to call a witch hunt, a coordinated regulatory assault designed to strangle a technology its overseers didn't understand and couldn't control. Regulators saw it differently. The crypto world was the Wild West, and even if the rules weren't perfect, at least it was a good start to protect American investors. President Joe Biden had installed Gary Gensler, a former Goldman Sachs partner, MIT blockchain professor, and thus a man who understood crypto better than almost any other regulator, to chair the SEC with the ambition to bring the industry to heel. The central question was whether cryptocurrencies were securities or commodities. The answer determined everything. Securities fall under SEC jurisdiction, meaning exchanges and token issuers would need to register, disclose, and comply with investor protection rules designed for stocks. Rules built for centralized institutions, not assets that could be sent and received anywhere on Earth without a bank, a broker, or a border. Applying traditional financial forms of regulation to a technology that was, at its core, about self-sovereignty, privacy, anonymity, and breaking down global borders was destined to fail. Described in the crypto world as regulation by enforcement, Gensler charged companies with violating securities laws and enforced a regulatory crackdown that squeezed crypto-friendly banks out of the system. The SEC at that time was trying to sue crypto out of existence, says Ryan, who recalls getting served with papers on Easter Sunday 2024 while setting the table for dinner. "I was the highest person at the Ethereum Foundation in the U.S., he says, plainly, when I asked why he thought he was targeted. Hayes was sentenced to 6 months of home confinement in May 2022 after pleading guilty to willfully failing to implement anti-money laundering controls at BitMEX, specifically for allowing American customers to access the platform via VPNs while publicly claiming otherwise. He had, at a conference, bragged that it was cheaper to bribe Seychelles officials than comply with U.S. regulations. Binance CEO Chengping Zhao, commonly known as CZ, fared worse. In April 2024, he was sentenced to 4 months in federal prison for enabling money laundering. Binance paid $4.3 billion in fines, one of the largest corporate penalties in U.S. history. Then Donald Trump had his second coming. Next photo, Devin Finzer and Yuchi Lira Kuo, the Build-A-Bear and the Product Mommy. Finzer met Kuo just as his NFT marketplace OpenSea was approaching a $13 billion valuation. "I crashed a New York Fashion Week party that she was hosting at her penthouse," says Finzer. "It was like all these crypto OGs, and she was just brilliantly immersed." 5 years later, the two are relaunching OpenSea, which cratered in 2022, together. Trump called Bitcoin a scam in 2021. 3 years later, he was keynoting the Bitcoin conference and promising to make America the crypto capital of the planet. Even though Trump embodied so many values that were antithetical to the globalist utopian vision of the crypto evangelist, his positive stance on the industry was enough to secure their votes. "I don't think there is a political party in the United States that is inherently pro or anti-crypto," says Hayes. "And if crypto investors act as single-issue voters, the question before politicians is really, do I want them or do I not want them? I think I'm the only person in crypto who didn't vote for Trump," says Novogratz, a major progressive donor who spent years unsuccessfully trying to get Elizabeth Warren to sit down with him about the industry. "It's still a politically charged industry, and it shouldn't be. It should be bipartisan," he says. "We need rules. One reason there's been no innovation is because there are no rules." Meanwhile, in the final months before Trump's re-election, Ryan got a letter, case closed. His lawyers, former SEC attorneys, told him they had never seen the agency do this before. "The best you get is they just stop talking to you," he says. Instead, his charge of securities fraud just evaporated. What happened? It was politics. let Ryan tell it. The Biden administration realized their margins in the presidential race were too close for comfort, and they could no longer afford to alienate all of tech. The industry would ultimately pour $135 million into the 2024 election, with most reportedly going to Republican candidates, and win more than 90% of the races it backed. In 2025, Trump launched Strump, his own meme coin, and the S is formed from a dollar symbol, which shot to a market cap of around $10 billion before cratering some 80% within weeks. And once he was inaugurated, he issued federal pardons to Hayes and Zhao. Bankman-Fried remains in prison. The supposed tourist followed swiftly with their own meme coins. Back at Nine Orchard, the photo shoot is underway and almost everyone has descended downstairs. I try to get Carlson Wee to finally talk politics as he puts the final touches on his outfit. He holds firm that he stays out of Washington. I say that growing up in D.C., I was raised with the belief that not following politics was immoral. It is, says Novogratz from the makeup chair across the room, not looking up. Carlson Wee drifts over to him. It was a striking posture for the first employee of Coinbase. Even as his former boss, Armstrong, had just stalled the Digital Asset Market Clarity Act, the sweeping legislation the crypto industry has spent years and millions of dollars fighting for, and rumor has it, pulling his support on the eve of the Senate vote, once the final draft threatened a revenue stream worth hundreds of millions of dollars annually. At Davos, J.P. Morgan's Jamie Dimon told Armstrong he was full of shit. Much of the crypto community agreed. Depending on one's vantage point, crypto's permeation of the establishment is either a betrayal of everything that it was supposed to be or proof that the experiment worked. Some of the most committed believers in decentralization are now in closed-door Oval Office meetings. Crypto is held not only by everyday people, but by sovereign wealth funds, family offices, and corporations with private wealth managers. The movement born to make Wall Street irrelevant has become one of its most powerful lobbying forces and its most reliable clients. We won, Moose had told me, but does winning just turn us into every other asset class? Is the industry becoming everything it hated, or changing the world from the inside out? This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available at our website as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.